Let's return now to 1 Kings chapter 7. Please be turning there. 1 Kings chapter 7. And let's see what else we can find of spiritually symbolic interest in the scriptural descriptions of these pillars. And more specifically, first of all, of the chapters of those pillars at the top of those pillars. So just to bring us up to date then, let's reread verses 15 and 16 of 1 Kings chapter 7. 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 15. For he cast two pillars of brass of 18 cubits high apiece. A line of 12 cubits did compass either of them about. And he made two chapiters of molten brass to set upon the tops of the pillars. The height of the one chapiter was 5 cubits, and the height of the other chapiter was 5 cubits. Okay, now continuing in verse 17. And nets of checkerwork and wreaths of chainwork for the chapiters which were upon the top of the pillars, 7 for the one chapiter and 7 for the other chapiter. 7 what? I guess 7 of these nets and wreaths. Hard to for us to decipher exactly what these things were, but they were somehow they were beautiful, intricate patterns that were either cast into the two chapiters or carved into them. The New King James Version verse 17 gives a somewhat clearer picture of what these must have looked like. It says, this is from the New King James Version, says, he made a lattice network with wreaths of chainwork for the capitals, in other words, the chapiters, which were on top of the pillars. So if you go on the internet, you can find posted there, you can find various artists' impressions of what those might have looked like, what the chapiters might have looked like, what these lattice networks and these wreaths of chainwork might have looked like, all pictured and posted on the internet. I went in, I looked up, and you can do this if you want, Google brass pillars of Solomon's temple, and then hit the images tab, and it'll just show you the pictures of them. Okay. But what did those patterns represent? What did those lattice networks and those wreaths of chainwork, what did they represent? What, if anything, did they represent? Were they merely decorative, or was there more to them than that? I went through the different Bible commentaries on this, and one Bible commentator, I can't remember which one it was, but one commentator notes very interestingly, he said, the nets and chains speak of captivity, constraint, and submission. Okay, that sounds a bit negative, I think. You know, thinking about all of the positive aspects and positive symbolisms of the different parts of the temple, captivity, constraint, and submission. Because, you know, we know that it's true that Jesus' sacrifice and our acceptance of Jesus' sacrifice actually frees us. It frees us from the bonds of Satan. It frees us from Satan's godless way of life. It frees us from Satan's counterfeit pseudo-religious ways of life. And, you know, any of the heathen religious beliefs that we might have held previously, you know, prior to our true calling and conversion, Jesus' sacrifice frees us from the bogus man-made Jewish traditions, and we've been finding that out over and over again. And even from, and Jesus' sacrifice even frees us from the hugely symbolic and prophetic rituals of the Old Covenant works of the law. Now, of course, you know, the Old Covenant works of the law, they definitely were valid at one time, because they were ordained by God the Father and by the Lord Yahweh, you know, the one who became Jesus. But right from the beginning of their plan, from the plan of God the Father and of the Lord Yahweh, they had prearranged to make those rituals obsolete by means of the great sacrifice of our Lord and Savior Jesus. We know that, you know. So they made those things, and if you look at it, those old covenant rituals, you know, the sacrifices and all of that, they were only in service from the time of the institution of the tent tabernacle up until 70 AD. I mean, really, till 30 AD when Jesus died. And again, not sure why, but for 40 more years, God allowed them to be carried on. But that is not a very long time. I can't remember exactly when, what the date of, I'd have to look that up and see again, when the date of what it was of the institution of the tent tabernacle and the institution of those old covenant sacrifices. But, you know, it was just for that specific time. After that, they were obsolete. And before that, they weren't even in service yet. Anyway, that's true. So we were freed. We were freed from all of those things. But although Jesus' sacrifice did free us from all of those various aspects of bondage, still, he and his Father tell us, and they tell us through many New Testament scriptures, that our servitude has now been transferred to them, so that we are now their servants. We are now servants of Jesus and servants of God the Father. Okay, now, let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 7, still in 1 Kings chapter 7. Let's continue in verse 18. And this is interesting now. Verse 18. And he made the pillars. What it means he decorated, he further decorated the pillars and two rows round about upon the one network to cover the chapiters that were upon the top with pomegranates, brethren, pomegranates. And so did he for the other chapiter. Pomegranates. Okay, why pomegranates? Why not bananas? Why not apples? Why not grapes? What symbolism could pomegranates hold? We're going to look into this in quite a bit of detail today. The Hebrew word for pomegranates is the noun rimonim. That's the Hebrew word rimonim. That you can look that up. That's Strong's 7406. By the way, I'm not sure whether you've got a paper copy of Strong's Concordance, but you'll find it all on the internet. You can look it up on there too. Rimonim. And rimonim stems from the root verb ramam, R-A-M-A-M. That's Strong's 7426. And that means, that word ramam means to be exalted, to be exalted. So once again, pointing to the two exalted ones who we now know as God the Father and Jesus, but who at that time in old covenant times were known as Elyon El, that was God the Father, and Yahweh. Not many people knew Elyon El back then. But if this exaltation aspect really is significant, which I believe it is, then the large number of 200 pomegranates might symbolize the requirements for lots of exaltation for God the Father and for Jesus. Okay, 200 pomegranates, would symbolize lots of exaltation. And if we think about that, when I think about that anyway, this thought perhaps takes us way forward in time to something that the Apostle John saw in his God-given revelation vision. Okay, so please bookmark 1 Kings chapter 7, and let's go over to Revelation chapter 4. Again, bookmark 1 Kings. Let's go over to Revelation chapter 4 and begin with verse 1. Astonishing vision here that John saw. But keep those pomegranates and keep that exaltation in the back of your mind. Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1. After this, I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven. Remember that door? A door was opened in heaven. And the first voice which I heard, and that voice was Jesus, tells us that earlier, that the first voice which I heard was as it were of a trumpet talking with me, which said, come up here. Come up here, and I will show you things which must be hereafter. That wasn't a suggestion to John. That was Jesus commanding. He loved John. John was, you know, we think he was one of his favorites. I don't know whether he was a real favorite, but John thought he was anyway. But we know that Jesus did love John especially, and he was commanding him in a loving way, come up here. I want you up here. And immediately, John says, I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was set in heaven, and one sat on that throne. So John was called up. He was called up in spirit to God's heavenly temple. And in the spirit, he walked past those two huge pillars, okay? Everything that's in the earthly temple was copies of what was in the heavenly temple. John was taken up in spirit, and you can imagine him there. So he's out in the spiritual courtyard in heaven, and he walked past those two huge pillars, and he walked through the porch, and he walked through the door that had been opened to him. It said the door had been opened to him, and in other words, that was the first door and its veil, the first veil. And then from there, he walked through the holy place, and he walked through the second door and the second veil, and into God's heavenly, most holy place. He actually went in spirit into the heavenly throne room of God the Father and Jesus. And what did he see? He said, you know, Jesus said that he was going to show him some amazing things. And here is one of the truly astonishing things that John saw in that throne room. Yeah, it's actually, if you say one thing, it was actually four things. Verse 8, jump down to verse 8. Verse 8, the four living creatures, each having six wings, were full of eyes around and within. You can't even imagine what they look like. And they do not rest day or night, saying, holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come. And so, they do not rest day or night in their worship and their exaltation of God. So they were illustrating just one example of that immense level of exaltation as symbolized by the 200 pomegranates on the chapiters of the temple's brass pillars. Okay, we're going to come back to John's vision and the pomegranates in a few minutes. Well, let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 7 right now. Let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 7. And where are we? We're up to verse 19. So the main chapiters, the main 5-cubit high bodies of the chapiters were actually not the very tops of the pillar assemblies, okay? they were the main, so you've got the pillar, you've got the chapiters that were, and the chapiters were 5 cubits high, but that was not the top. So if they weren't the top, what was the top? Okay, verse 19, 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 19. And the chapiters that were upon the top of the pillars were of lily work in the porch, 4 cubits. So this lily work was at the very top of the pillars, stretching upward for another 4 cubits. And that was another approximately 6 feet above the main bodies of the chapiters. So you got the pillars, you've got the main body of the chapiters, which was 5 cubits high, and then you've got this another 4 cubits for this lily work on the top. That was the very top. So as this lily work section was at the very top of the two pillar assemblies, and as we saw last time, that the 5 cubit high bodies of the chapiters might have represented the Lord Yahweh, who became Jesus, perhaps this uppermost lily work embellishment part might have represented Elyon El, the Most High God, God the Father. Okay, why lilies? Why lilies? And again, same as with the pomegranates. Why not roses? Why not carnations or gladioli? Why not dahlias or chrysanthemums? The Hebrew word is symbolic. The Hebrew word for lily is shushan or shoshan, and Strong's 7799. And it stems from a verb, from the root verb sus, S-U-W-S, and that's Strong's 7797. And sus means to exult, to rejoice, to be glad, and to display joy or mirth. And all of those things certainly do apply to our great God. And in all of those things, God's people should strive to emulate him. We should exult. We should rejoice. We should be glad in what God the Father and Jesus have given us and have done to us. We should have joy over that. So just like many of the aspects of their wonderful creation, these details, these fine details on the two pillars and the assemblies might symbolize many of the attributes of Jesus and God the Father, including their appreciation and their ability for art and color and design, for intriguing patterns, as we've seen, and yes, even for humor. You know, that word sus means to display mirth. And we know very well that, you know, God the Father and Jesus have a great sense of humor. Just look at the animals in their creation, you know, and the design, the fabulous design. The things like the duck-billed platypus and stuff like that. And if there isn't humor in there, I'm sure you've got many more examples of that. So this might not be all. You know, there might be some more very relevant symbolism here. And the reason I say that is that the Hebrew, as well as lily, the Hebrew word shoshan can also refer to a trumpet. And we find it untranslated in the introduction to Psalm 45. You don't have to turn there. Psalm 45 and Psalm 69. I'll just quote it. In both cases, it's in the introduction before the main body of the psalm. It says, to the chief musician upon Shoshanim. And this is like, this is because the bell of a trumpet, you know, where it widens out at the end of a trumpet, that has a similar shape to the flower of a lily. And so the, you know, what was actually carved into that section at the very top may have looked like a lily, or it may have looked like the bell of a trumpet, you know. Okay, now the prophetic significance of Shoshanim, you know, of trumpets, obviously it should be obvious to us all. And if we actually go back, and we're not going to do it now for time's sake, but if you have time, go back and take a look at Psalm 45 and 69, and you'll see that both of those psalms contain allusions to the fulfillment of the Feast of Trumpets, you know, and so, you know, the fulfillment of the Feast of Trumpets must have been so very precious in the foresight of David and to the other psalmists as well. And must also, of course, still be to this day, must be very precious in the foresight of God the Father. Hence the inclusion of these lily trumpet patterns at the very tops of the two brass pillar assemblies. Okay, let's move on. As we move on here, let's just reread verse 19. So first, still in 1 Kings chapter 7, let's reread verse 19. And the chapiters that were upon the top of the pillars were of lily work in the porch 4 cubits. And I want to concentrate on the words in the porch. Now, I looked through my Bible commentaries there, and none of the commentators remark to in any significant detail on these words in the porch. Well, I believe that there's a great possibility that rather than those two huge pillars, those two huge black brass pillars being freestanding, as most artists' impressions show them to be, okay, in other words, freestanding and holding up nothing, just standing there with, you know, with nothing between their lily work tops and the heaven above them, I believe that rather they actually would have been inside the porch, inside the front of the porch, holding up its roof. Okay? And that's, you know, it's actually said this twice. There's another verse earlier on that indicated that they were in the porch. And that makes a lot of sense too, you know, because the porch itself is important. It's significant. And the porch itself might have borne some very important symbolism, because this porch, the front porch of the temple and the temple front door and its veil, the first veil, together, those three sections comprise the one and only entrance into the temple building. First of all, the one and only entrance into the holy place, so, you know, for the regular priests to go in and do their work in there. And on the Day of Atonement every year, it was the high priest's one and only entrance into the most holy place, of course, via the holy place, of course. So the high priest had to come in from the inner courtyard, through the porch, through the main door, through the first veil, through the holy place, through the second door and the second veil, into the most holy place. So perhaps this porch, along with the temple's front door and its first veil, might symbolize the one and only access for Christians, for you and me, brethren, for us, for us new covenant kings and priests in training, to gain access to and to gain contact with God the Father. And that is, you know, that contact with God the Father, that's two-way contact with God the Father in his heavenly throne room. Every time we talk to him in prayer, and every time we listen to him through our Bible study. But again, both of those only possible via our one and only mediator, which is Jesus. Jesus is the door. Now, let's bookmark 1 Kings chapter 7 again, please, brethren. And let's just take a quick look at a few later mentions of this one and only access to God the Father. And actually, there's three mentions we're going to go through here, three scriptures, all of them spoken by Jesus himself. And his first mention is this one, in which he warned the Jews, and especially he warned the Pharisees, never to attempt access to his Father by any other means. Please turn to John chapter 10, the Gospel of John chapter 10. Gospel of John chapter 10 and verse 1. Verily, verily, I say unto you, and see, there's one really excellent Bible version. And instead of verily, verily, it says, I'm telling you the truth. You know, it's like Jesus saying, I'm telling you the truth. He that enters not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he that enters in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. It says, so, you know, that's not just Jesus himself. We're talking about us as sub-shepherds under the leadership of the chief shepherd, which is Jesus himself. Verse 3. To him, you know, to us, the porter or the doorkeeper opens. Jump down to verse 7. Then said Jesus unto them again, verily, verily, I say unto you, I'm telling you the truth. I am the door of the sheep. And again in verse 9, I am the door. There's another I am statement by Jesus. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved. He shall be saved. Okay, that's two of those scriptures. Now the third one, 60 odd years after he said these words to these Jews, this is what the risen and glorified Jesus said to his people of the Philadelphia church via the assigned angel and through an extra special vision that he gave to his beloved apostle John. We're going to go back to Revelation again. And this is Revelation. We're in chapter 4 before. We're in Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 7. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he that is holy, he that is true, he that has the key of David. The key of David, the key to what? The key to what? Still in verse 7. He that opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens. So this key can lock something, but it can also unlock and open something. So opens and shuts. What? Verse 8. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you, Philadelphia Church, I have set before you an open door, and no man can shut it. So what is that door? that what is that door that Jesus opened, yeah, for the Philadelphia brethren to open, to walk through, but also for the Apostle John to walk through in spirit, of course. What is its type and what is its anti-type? Okay, let's go over into chapter 4 again. Let's come back to chapter 4 and let's reread verse 1 again. After this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven, and the first voice which I heard, that was Jesus' voice, was as it were of a trumpet, talking with me, which said, come up here, and I will show you things which must be hereafter. So, what was the very first thing that Jesus showed to his beloved Apostle John? Once John, in spirit, passed through that door that had been opened to him, and once he, in spirit, went up there as he'd been commanded, what was the very first thing that John was given to see? Verse 2. And immediately I was in the spirit, and behold, a throne was set in heaven, and one sat on the throne. So just try and visualize this, brethren. John was taken in spirit into the very throne room of God. John was given access to the spiritual original of the physical most holy place of Solomon's temple. And what did he see? The first thing, you know, before he saw those living creatures exalting God, what was the first thing that he saw? He saw the spiritual original of the physical Ark of the Covenant, along with its two-person mercy seat. Not only that, but John was also given to see one person, one of the God family members, sitting on that throne. Which one was it? Which one did he see? Well, John doesn't actually tell us, not in so many words anyway. Well, we're told back in chapter 1, at the beginning of John's revelation vision, that the glorified Jesus was behind him, was behind John. So here in chapter 4, we can imagine Jesus, you know, behind John, behind the understandably very nervous John, who wouldn't be, but ushering him forward, encouraging him in a loving way, but also super keen to show all of these amazing things to John that he was going to show him and that John was going to pass on to us, things that were in front of him. Jesus was behind him, kind of patting him on the back, saying, come on, John, come on, ushering him forward. And the most amazing of these things was Jesus's Father. So once again, brethren, all of these heavenly quote-unquote things, the actual spiritual antitypes of those physical rooms and courts and furnishings, all of which were designed by God, who gave his design to David to have built by Solomon and Hiram and their craftsmen into that first physical stone temple. Just blows your mind, the symbolism there. Somebody says that they think that the Holy Bible is just a bunch of words cobbled together, a bunch of made up events cobbled together. It's, brethren, they're just not given to know what you and me have been privileged to know. So let's get back again to the temple's building project. Let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 7 for the last time, I believe, today. Let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 7 and continue in verse 20. And the chapiters upon the two pillars, and the words have actually been added in there, had pomegranates. Also above, and the words over again have been added in there too, the belly being the hollows or the main bodies of the chapiters, which was by the network. Okay, so if you read that without those added bits in there, it should read, and the chapiters upon the two pillars also above the belly, which was by the network. Okay, now again, although the words had pomegranates in there were implied and added in there by the King James Version translators, the original authors of this first book of Kings do take us back now to the subtopic of those pomegranates, which they first introduced to us back in verse 18. So second half of verse 20 now. And the pomegranates were 200 in rows round about upon the other chapiter. So apparently I look back into the original, I think it was the original Hebrew, to see, you know, were there 100 pomegranates on one and 100 on the other, or were there 200 on each of them? It's hard to distinguish, but there's still a lot anyway. I mean, whether it's 100 or 200, that is a lot of pomegranates to carve in there and to design in there. So this indicates that it indicates a very intricate design of every part of the temple, and especially these pillars here. But does this number 200, does it also have any symbolic meaning? I'm not sure whether you're familiar. There's a book by a man by the name of E.W. Bullinger. It's an excellent book. It's called Number in Scripture. And what he does, he actually goes through all of the numbers that are mentioned in the Bible, and he looks for patterns in them. He looks to see if because of their use in lots of different places, whether they repeat themselves and indicate a certain meaning. So here's the one that he says for the number 200. By the way, you can actually download this book for free off the internet. So here's what he says about 200. He says, number 20 is the number of expectancy. Just keep that in the back of your mind, as we have seen. Here, he says, we have it tenfold. In other words, 20 times 10. Then he says, the significance of this number, 200, suggested by John chapter 6 and verse 7, you don't have to turn there, where we read, 200 pennyworth of bread is not sufficient for them. And so we find this number stamping various things with insufficiency. Bullinger then cites four more scriptural examples relating the number 200 with insufficiency. But does the number 200 mean insufficiency in every scriptural case, including this one of the 200 pomegranates on each chapter atop the brass pillars? Does it? Of course, so we think of insufficiency, and we think in comparison with the perfect activities of the two great God beings, whatever things, even the relatively good things that human beings can do, even the very best of the works of human beings, and yes, even the building of a physical earthly dwelling for God to visit, all of these things, of course, are comparatively, compared with God's works, are comparatively very imperfect and very insufficient. But what I questioned here from what Bullinger said, would God allow a symbol of imperfection an insufficiency, would he allow it that to be incorporated into his temple design? I am thinking, no, no. You know, and I'm certainly not going to negate everything that Bullinger wrote here. I would prefer to concentrate on his opening remarks to that section on the number 200, where he wrote that if the number 20 represents expectancy, then 200 might represent expectancy tenfold. And expectancy certainly is a far more positive term than insufficiency. Let's concentrate for a little bit on that word expectancy. Expectancy. Jesus has great expectancy. He has great expectancy for his future return to this earth. He has great expectancy for lifting up his faithful sisters and brothers. He has great expectancy for the putting down of his incorrigible enemies. Let's look into this a little bit. Now, you don't need to bookmark because we're finished in First Kings for today. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 10. Just one short verse here. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 13. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 13 says, from henceforth expecting, this is referring to Jesus, till his enemies be made his footstool. We're looking forward to that day. And Jesus wants all of us to have the right kinds of expectancy too. You know, not of a vain or a selfish kind of expectancy, you know, I deserve this and you know, you've got to give me that. But with the proper kind of boldness, you know, that's inspired into us by God's Holy Spirit. And just as the Apostle Paul had, let's look at Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 20. Whether you've read the book by Charles Dickens or seen the movie Great Expectations, wonderful story. And a wonderful concept too. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 20. According to my earnest expectation, this is the Apostle Paul, my earnest expectation and hope that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but that with all boldness, the proper kind of boldness, brethren, as always, so now also Christ shall be magnified in my body, whether it be by life or by death. You know, in other words, this expectancy for the future, the Apostle Paul basically saying, it doesn't matter, you know, if I can magnify Jesus Christ through whatever I can do on this earth physically with my body, whether it be through the rest of my life or if the Romans are going to put an end to me by my death, you know. So this same earnest expectation and hope for the fulfillment of God's sure prophecies, it's actually experienced, you know, not only by Jesus and not only by Jesus's fellow children of God, but theoretically and even geographically, brethren, by the whole of God's creation. And the whole of God's creation, which is groaning, just as we should be groaning, brethren, just as we should be sighing and crying because of this war-racked age, and, you know, sighing and crying for it to be completed, for it to be over, and for God's kingdom of peace to come. Let's go to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, last scripture for today, brethren. Romans chapter 8, beginning at verse 18. Romans chapter 8, 18. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation, there the Apostle Paul says that again, the earnest expectation of the creation waits for the manifestation of the sons of God and the daughters of God too. Verse 22, for we know that the whole creation groans and travails in pain together until now, and not only that, not only the whole creation, but ourselves also, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, waiting for actually the sonship, to wit, the redemption of our body, the buying back of our body. So that waiting and that hoping and that groaning and that travailing, all of them, they are all symptoms of our expectation of Jesus' return and our expectation of our resurrection and our change from our pain-racked physical bodies to our future pain-free spiritual bodies, and to the straightening out of this pain-filled world and of its transformation into the wonderful world tomorrow. So I could finish there, but I've got just one more little postscript for what we've covered so far today. I didn't want to move away. I didn't want to leave those pomegranates before we close. Just a couple more words about those pomegranates and one more possibility about them. I looked into the origins, of course. I looked into the Hebrew word pomegranate, but I was also wanted to look into the origins of the English word pomegranate. Where do we get that? A funny word, isn't it? Pomegranate. So I looked into it, and it said, looked into the what they call the etymology of it, and it says that the pom part comes from the French word for apple, right? Pom is an apple. And the second part, granite, G-R-A-N-A-T-E, when it's spelt with an I, as it most commonly is in this day and age, granite, granite, which of course is a super solid kind of what? Rock. And to quote the Apostle Paul, that rock was Christ, right? Yeah. But the word granite also stems from the root word as the one for the words grainy and granule. If you actually see granite stone, you see that it's like the way it was formed. And I'm not a geologist by any means, but if you see, you know what, you'll know granite when you see it, because it looks grainy. It's got little black dots in it, and it's not smooth. You run your hand over it, and it's grainy like that, you know. And of course, if you looked at split open a pomegranate, and it's grainy, right? They're all of the different little bits of fruit are like grains in there. So, but notably, okay, the word granite also stems from that same root word as the one for the word grain, grainy, and granular. And notably, this one that jumped right out at me, and it's another kind of stone, another kind of rock. And that's a precious stone called garnet. Garnet, G-A-R-N-E-T. And I looked that up. I looked up the Oxford Language Dictionary there on the word garnet. And here's what it says. It says the word garnet stems from the Latin granatum. And it says, see pomegranate. So it refers it right to the word pomegranate. And it says, because the garnet stone is similar in color to the pulp of the pomegranate fruit. Interesting, eh? So my question here, as we conclude here, is could it be possible that these 200 pomegranates that were depicted in the two chapters of the temple's brass pillars, Could it be possible that they might actually have been 200 precious garnet stones? Is that possible? We read in other places that there were valuable stones that were built into in various parts of the temple structure. Okay, that's just a possibility. But brethren, we're out of time for today, so we're going to finish with that for today. But, you know, we have not quite finished with those brass pillars. We've got a bit more to study on them. We have not yet looked into the thought-provoking names that God gave to those two pillars. And we have not looked at the meanings of those names. So that's where we're going to begin next time in part 60 of our study.